Welcome to Doctor Who On Target. A podcast where we discuss the target range of classic Doctor Who novelisations from the 1970s and 80s. Those long ago days where, if you missed Doctor Who on TV, you missed it forever. Unless, of course, you bought the Target novelisation. So, join us, jump aboard the TARDIS, set the time rotor for late 20th century Earth, and, with a wheezing, groaning sound, we'll discuss Doctor Who on Target. Hello and welcome to Doctor Who on Target. This is Greg in Swansea.
And this is David in Chelmsford.
And today we're going to be discussing Empress of Mars. Now, I've been a little bit delayed watching this, and so I watched it. David, you gave me a bit of a heads up. You gave me a bit of a hint as to what you thought I would think of it, didn't you?
Yes, we spent the last podcast discussing the Monk trilogy. And whether we thought it was monkey magic or monkey business, I think we decided it was the latter. Yeah. But I did promise you at the end of that podcast that the next time we spoke, you and I would have fallen back in love with Doctor Who. So the big question is, did it happen?
Well, I actually watched it at midnight last night. We were out in the day and I got back and cleared the house and I put my headphones on, switched all the lights off. And, do you know, it was like going back in time. It was classic Doctor Who. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. It was so great. You know, I had a big grin on my face. I just thought, it just had Mark Gate. I wonder if it's the best script Mark Gate has ever written, actually.
It's very close. I mean, he does have, from my trip to Swansea, you took me to one of the locations, but his other Victorian era scripts are The Unquiet Dead from 2005, and that's the one we went to, and The Crimson Horror, both of which I hugely enjoyed. Yes, I think you're right. I think this could be right up there with his very best Doctor Who script. So if it is the last one, and there are plenty of internet rumours to that effect, at least he's gone out on a high.
Oh, it's absolutely, he's just nailed it. Everything goes. I mean, the atmosphere was lovely. It was classic Doctor Who, you know. It had the scares. It was quite interesting because it felt so much like classic Doctor Who, but on a big budget, because the photography of the Mars surface and the caves and everything was great. I thought the Ice Warriors looked tremendous, and I was really impressed with the Empress of Mars, the Queen, Ice Queen. What did you think, David?
Well, I loved the new Ice Warriors, and I did love, she's called Iraxa, and she's the Empress of Mars herself, isn't she? And she had these dreadlocks at the back that made her look a bit like Predator, from the Predator films. So she was a formidable adversary, and she certainly was inclined to be quite angry and scary. So I did enjoy the Ice Warriors. I think I described them as the fifth best Doctor Who monster. I think what it is about the Ice Warriors, because they appear in what's known as the monster season, Patrick Troughton's second season, a lot of the monsters in that season are considered Doctor Who favourites, like Dalek, Cybermen, Yeti, Ice Warriors. They're all in there, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely.
So they've got a real. The Ice Warriors are classic Who down to their very toenails. They really are. If they even have toenails, I don't know if they do. They probably just have claws or talons or something. But anyway, no. And I tell you something else I really, really liked, and that was their new weaponry. They used to have this thing where it sort of used to wobble and distort, and their victim would collapse, but now their victim gets screwed up into a ball and sort of discarded like an old sock.
It was really effective,
it was
wasn't it?
It was bloodless and it was horrible.
Yeah, it was really effective, wasn't it? First of all, I had that feeling when I saw that happen to go, oh, did I just see what I think I saw, you know? And you're sort of looking at the clothes to see, you know, had the person been squished up inside it or were they? And, oh, it was quite horrible. It was, it's quite, I had that weird sensation. Well, it was so horrible that I wanted to keep seeing them doing it, you know?
That, no, that, it really is unfortunate. It shouldn't have that effect. Violence begets violence. Don't forget that.
Yeah, that's true. That is true, yes.
But to pull back to the very, very start of the show, which I feel we should do, do you know how I always want to make links to William Hartnell's Doctor?
You do, yes, yeah.
And I thought this episode had defeated me. Of course, this is set in 1881, which is exactly the same year that Doctor Who The Gunfighters is set. It's the year of the gunfight at the OK Corral.
Oh my gosh.
And if you recall, the first Doctor was at large in Tombstone at this same time, posing as Dr. Caligari, which itself was an in-joke. It's after the 1920 film, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. But yes, so I've made a link, so box ticked.
Well, I didn't spot that one, I can tell you that.
Well, yes, as I say, 1881 is when it all happened. So parallel time to the Empress of Mars, we have the first Doctor in Tombstone.
That's a really good... I wonder, when I first saw the episode opening, I was a bit tenuous in thinking, you know, how is this going to happen, you know, Victorian soldiers on Mars, and I had some sort of Jules Verne feel to it, what was going to happen, and it was very well thought out, but I was wrong-footed a bit at the beginning with the NASA bit. I wondered what on earth was going on there.
Well, yes, I still can't work out whether they went to NASA first, saw God Save the Queen, and then had the adventure, or, as I'd originally interpreted it, they turned up at NASA to see their handiwork unveiled by this new camera that could see through the surface of Mars. And I decided on the latter. But if it is the latter, it means that there was never any threat from Missy. Because Missy isn't at NASA, is she?
No.
She's in the TARDIS at the end, but she's not at NASA. So there was never any consequence from her being released, it seems.
That
was my observation, but I was confused by that. But I've got it straight in my mind now that they went back, they went forward to NASA just to witness the unveiling of those stones that said "God Save the Queen."
So they were being a bit mischievous then.
They were being very, very mischievous. It was all a bit tongue in cheek that bit, but none the worse for it. No.
Well, there were many surprises in this and little mischievous things. And we'll get on to the final one, couple at the end, I think.
Oh, yes, but we've got to save that big reveal to the end, definitely.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So David, I'm watching this at midnight in the dark, and it's absolutely great. It's got the tension, it's mysterious. I'm loving what's going to happen here, because it reminded me, it had... I think Mark Gatiss and the directors and everyone involved have managed to amalgamate these series of classical type adventure stories. Like I said, the Boy's Own Adventure.
You said that last podcast, yes.
Did I? Oh my gosh, yes. Oh, the Jules Verne feel to it. And I also felt, you know, when we got in, you know, with the soldiers going there, I don't know, it gave me... What's that, the Sean Connery film now?
Oh,
you know,
The Man Who Would Be King.
Yes. It had that feel on it, you know, they were in somewhere far, far away, you know, from the centre of the British Empire, but by golly, they were carrying on as well, you know.
And, they were carrying on as if they owned the place.
Absolutely. And there was a surprising reversal this time, wasn't it? Because... you know, the fact is they were on the side, I keep saying the side, but the Ice Warriors' home planet. So they were the invaders. But at the same time, they'd been invited there. There was a bit of to-ing and fro-ing with the morals in this one, I felt.
A little bit, because the doctors couldn't really side with anyone, and his job was just to stop each side from killing the other one, I think. Yeah, but yes, the doctor has been in a position before where colonists have arrived on and have come into conflict with an indigenous population. I think the most obvious example would be Colony in Space, perhaps. The show has certainly looked on the rights and wrongs of sort of the colonial process.
Yeah,
for want of a better word. I'm just gonna rewind a tiny, tiny bit because I want to read my notes.
Yeah.
You've said Jules Verne and you've said A Boy's Own Adventure, and I agree with all of that. And I wrote a bit like an episode of Michael Palin's Ripping Yarns meets Tomb of the Cybermen.
Wow. That is a great that's a great mix up. I like that.
And then I wrote full on British pluck on display as the challenge of overcoming a bunch of upright crocodiles is met head on.
Well, that is great, because you snatched the fabulous phrase out of there, isn't it? Upright crocodiles.
That was my favourite. That was one of my favourite bits. The bunch of upright. Yeah. Well, I think the British Army is more than a match for a bunch of upright crocodiles. It was great. British pluck. Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. And also, what I did like as well is. Mark Gatiss didn't steer clear of, being ironic and causing, you know, a bit of mischief in his perceptions as well. Because of course, we had the officer who deserted and been hanged for desertion.
That's true.
We had the officers who weren't obeying the rules, even though it's all about you must follow the rules. And but we had the one below him. I've forgotten his name now.
I know Jackdaw was the one who caused all the trouble by prizing the jewel off the tomb.
Yes.
Jackdaw, he was the one who drugged the next his next in command, wasn't he?
That's right. He drugged him. Yeah, we had those who were while the cat's away, the mice will play.
Absolutely.
They were up to,
Well, you had both hierarchies, didn't you? You had two very hierarchical systems, and the story managed to follow them both simultaneously. So you had the Empress down to the foot soldiers on the Ice Warrior side, and then you had the Colonel down to the sort of the lower ranks, the private, who was basically feathering his own nest. Because what I thought was, I thought Araxes' tomb, that reminded me a bit of the honey trap that was Rassilon's tomb in The Five Doctors. When he started prizing at that jewel with his knife, he just knew it wasn't going to end happily.
Oh, you did. It was real suspense in that. I loved all of it. Even, you know, when the hole, you know, appeared and sort of swallowed Bill up and that went down. I thought that was really effective because it clearly was a really deep hole with the earth sort of eating her alive. And I thought that was really good, because that could have been done a lot simpler and easier. But that was great. That really added to that sense of peril, you know. I love that.
Bill seems to fall into a hole every week these days.
Yeah, well, yes.
Is that a spoiler?
Yeah.
She does. She falls down one hole an episode at the moment.
Yeah, that's true. That's probably why they're coming up with such ingenious ways of making it look different, I suppose. I love that. And, you know, I love the way that Mark Gatiss, I suppose, has got that. He's really got that feel for Victoriana, hasn't he? You know, the way when they unveil, because I actually had, you mentioned Tomb of the Cybermen, which I completely agree with, but I was also getting a Power of the Daleks vibe from it.
I almost put Power of the Daleks, but I decided on Tomb of the Cybermen because the Hive came to life. But you're right, the idea, it was something about the Daleks managed to hide most of their numbers, didn't they? And there were only three on display.
Yes,
just like the Ice Warriors, they thought they were only opposing two of them, and then loads of them turned up for the battle. Oops.
Exactly. But yeah, no, but also, the crux of the story as well was, not the crux of the story, but the beginning of the story, we know that he was persuading the platoon, I think it is, what they call squadron.
Right. Yes, it was. Yes, well, the soldiers, for want of a better description.
Yes, yes, he was persuading them that he needed help, and that he promised them all sorts of riches if they would come back to the planet. And so it was this sort of planet of the Daleks. Like, it was only one of them. He's bringing them tea. Power of the Daleks, sorry.
Yeah,
he's bringing them tea and doing all this. He's not a threat. He's there. So I had that feel from it as well. And I think, you know, there was a little sort of hint at that. And wasn't there a piece with a plate?
Yes, where he caught it as a reflex, didn't he?
Yes, he did. That's right. Yeah, and you know, I also loved, I loved that first moment when we encountered the Ice Warrior when he was coming up, because of course he's on his home planet now, and he went at a heck of a speed towards the Doctor, didn't he?
Oh, he did. It was a good reversal as well. It was a very good reversal, because the Doctor mistakenly thought the soldier intended to save him from the monster, but it was actually the other way around.
Yeah.
So it was quite a nice touch.
It was. It was a really lovely touch. And then after that, I thought another lovely moment was when he was saying, how could you get through this? How could you possibly hope to achieve this? And they turned around and they had the, was it the Gargantuan?
The Gargantua.
And I thought, that is so Victorian British, you know. We are going to do everything because we've got this huge gun, you know.
But funny enough,
I loved that.
Yes, I agree with you. Funny enough, the Gargantua reminded me of Eckersley's mining equipment from the Monster of Peladon, which was causing all the trouble with the miners. Because they were all a bunch of Luddites who wanted to keep scrabbling around with their hands.
Oh, yes, and of course.
I could be misremembering, but I thought that Eckersley turned his mining machine into a weapon at one stage. I could have misremembered that, but definitely there was mining equipment, wasn't there, in the Monster Peloton, which
was
ahead of its time and place.
Well, do you know, that's quite interesting, because you mentioned a Tomb of the Cyberman feel. I said about the Power of the Daleks feel. And going on that sense of duplicity and tricking people into thinking you are not dangerous, that you are their friend. I thought, actually, when you think about it, it's actually pretty quintessential Ice Warrior, isn't it? Because isn't that what happened twice in the Pertwee era?
They flip-flop between sides, don't they?
Yeah.
They are. Never quite know how they're going to be when they appear, because they've been goodies and they've been baddies.
Yeah. And that's what I thought, that's really interesting. But of course, we had that amplified within this, because we had that a great Ice Queen, you know. So what's her name again, David?
Iraxa.
Now, I've seen a few comments today saying that people thought her voice was grating, but I thought that's how it should be. She was a right old fierce Ice Queen, you know, Iraxa. And I thought she was, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought her voice was really effective. Did you, David?
I had no issue with her voice at all. I think after all those years of hibernation, she probably would have been a bit croaky and could probably have used a Strepsil, but there you go. So I think if people are being critical of her voice, I think, well, okay, there's nothing else to be critical of, so that's, we'll let that pass. But it did great with me. I thought it was very effective.
So did I. I thought it was very effective. She was played very, very well indeed, you know. And what I liked again, and we have seen this with the Ice Warriors in the past, is, you know, proper individual characterization. Mm. And this went into a right topsy-turvy world here with the rescued Ice Warrior.
Friday.
Going against... Sorry?
He's called Friday.
Friday, sorry, of course, yes, a lovely allusion there, Friday. So we had Friday turning against his Axia, isn't it? Araxia. We had Friday turning against Araxia, saying that, you know, they had helped him, they had, you know, enabled him to revive the Ice Warriors, and him wanting to sort of come to a solution between them, is it, rather than just destroy them? What did you think of that, David? Was that...
Well, yes, I understand the point that you're making. I mean, Friday had almost... I guess her gripe with Friday, Araxa's gripe with Friday, is that he'd almost... What's that thing you get where you come to sympathise with your kidnapper? Stockholm Syndrome.
Oh, yes.
I think she thought he'd turned and had forgotten his roots. And to a point he had. Yeah. Perhaps he'd been semi-civilised by
That's
the company he'd been keeping. And perhaps he had broadened his own thinking beyond... Because her thinking was that of a warrior. And the Doctor is able to bring a successful conclusion to the story because he says he thinks like a warrior.
Yes.
But perhaps...
Yeah.
It's interesting, actually, because many years ago when I was at university, we did actually look at Robinson Crusoe, which is where Friday comes from, and it did reveal itself to be one of the great Enlightenment works of literature.
Really?
Because, yes, because Crusoe's stuck on an island and there's a scene with some cannibals and they're about to have dinner, and Crusoe has this amazing internal dialogue with himself over the rights and wrongs of intervening to change the cannibals' ways. Because he thinks, well, they're wicked and they're absolutely demonstrably wicked, but do I have the right to judge and execute them, or does that usurp the power of God? And I think it's only when they start licking their lips because they're about to eat a Spaniard that he actually leaps into action and intervenes. So, so it's all there. There's also a film apparently called Robinson Crusoe on Mars, which had the late Adam West in it. So
that was a 1950s B movie.
Well, 1964 the movie was made. It was pre Batman for Adam West, and I really should dig that one out and watch it to see if there are any other allusions to it. But no, Friday, the original Friday in Robinson Crusoe, was going to be dinner at one point, and because Crusoe saves him, he forms this incredible attachment. And I just guess the point I'm making rather long-windedly is, perhaps Friday was, you know, had that residual loyalty to his saviours. And
yes,
that's why
yeah.
he acted as he acted.
Yes, yeah, because he was certainly thinking things through. I mean, he was discussing it with her. He gave her the reasons. He gave her, he said, things have changed. We've overslept by his calculation 5,000 years. Mm. So whatever was happening, he was saying, look, the situation's different now. Let's sort of... think this through, if you like, you know. And but of course she reminded him, didn't she, that, you know, did she say something like you've forgotten your warrior code or something like and she was all for it because she'd just woken up and she had that fire in her belly, didn't she?
Well, she did indeed. But he'd joined the Age of Reason, hadn't he?
He absolutely. And nicely put, David. Yeah, I wonder, I love that bit you mentioned, Tomb of the Cybermen, and we certainly had that when the camera panned upwards and we had floor upon floor of these cells with the Ice Warriors in. I loved that, and it made me think, in a way, sometimes I get a little bit reminiscent, especially if a story is reminding me of the classic era. And I was thinking Ark in Space as well.
Oh, yes,
Yeah. Did you get that,
all
that
the great,
feeling?
Yes, all the great cryogenic stories.
Yes,
Where survival... And I suppose to an extent the Silurians as well. They emerged from tombs having overslept, didn't they?
Yes, yeah, they did. But I don't think we had any big reveal of those, did we?
No.
There was no big set it's no, piece
they
of...
just were, weren't they? They just, yeah, they just appeared. But I mean, the same idea of the a species being dormant and then wanting the planet. But Mars, yeah. As you say, things have moved on, and the doctor called Mars, or somebody called Mars, as dead as a coffin nail. It's as if being as dead as a doornail wasn't sufficient.
Yeah,
it had to be as dead as something that had been hammered into something to contain the dead.
Oh,
it was that dead.
You see, well, it's the language. I mean, Mark Gatiss has got such a wonderful feel for the language. I mean, everything here, I mean, Mark Gatiss is steeped in Victoriana, horror, in threat. You know, he's got all of this to hand, doesn't he?
I mean, he's done this deliberately, hasn't he? It's 1881, and he's playing. So that's 4 years after Victoria became the Empress of India. So you've got the two empresses in the background there, and it's 2 years after the Battle of Rorke's Drift, when I think it was 150 English soldiers held off, by Michael Caine's calculation, thousands of Zulus. So that's the sort of pluck that we're dealing with at this point.
Very absolutely.
Much enjoyed.
It was. I mean, I think you said to me at the end of the last podcast, you know, that it's not deep, the story, but that you're going to love it, and I do agree, but it's deep enough for me. I think it's sufficient enough
wasn't it? I mean. I'm going to throw a word in now and see what you think. And I put this in my notes. I put, this is the first story for a long time that I would be comfortable describing as a romp.
Yeah, I think it's the first romp because, and, you know, we might have to go to Mark Gatiss for the last romp, I suppose, which was, would that be Robert of Sherwood? Would that be a romp?
Yes, Robert of Sherwood would be the last romp.
Yeah.
But I think that was possibly less successful than this one.
Oh, I think it was a lot less successful.
But I know you have very
this.
Special memories of it, which is great. Oh,
seeing the filming of that, you know, Sherwood. Which, of course, you know... you know, Peter Capaldi hadn't even been on screen at that time.
And
he, and it was fabulous. And he was such a gentleman. And Jenna Coleman was so gorgeous and polite and nice. And they came over, you know, to talk to us, and they were loved. And I had a pen which didn't work, you know, and Peter Capaldi said, it's okay, we'll get it working now. We had time, you know.
That's always nice, isn't it, when people make time to be kind. There's enough non-kindness in this world, if that's a word.
There's enough unkindness
in this world. It's nice that somebody would actually take the time and the trouble. And, of course, you mentioned Jenna Coleman, who ironically looks like a young Queen Victoria, apparently.
Oh, of course. Yes.
You met young Queen Victoria there.
Oh, yes, I did indeed. Yes,
did you notice that they had a portrait of Pauline Collins, who looks like old Queen Victoria?
I love that, That was nice, wasn't it? That was nice that
nice
she did that.
Nice callback to Tooth and Claw there.
Yeah, that was lovely, and one of the great missed opportunities of companionship there, wasn't it, Pauline Collins?
Oh, yes.
She was offered the part, wasn't she, in the 60s?
Yeah, she played the part, but only for one story.
That's it, yeah. She would have been fabulous in it. She would have been great.
Good,
but,
wouldn't it?
Yeah. But
anyway,
I,
back to the rompiness of this particular show.
Yeah.
Anything to add there? Because my notes said something along the lines of, gone is the revisionist posturing of Sarah Dollard's allegorical take on slavery's role in the building of the British Empire, or the one about the monster chained to the bottom of the Thames that produced an awful lot of poo, if you listen to our podcast. And in come these characters with self-confidence and a sense of achievement that only turning a huge proportion of the globe pink can give our small island nation. And I think we've been very clear that we didn't enjoy the revisionism of Thin Ice at all, but I had no problems with the portrayal of the Empire this time. I think that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's a truthful portrayal. You know, it was. This is something, you know, we can look at in terms of, we're not saying, is it good, is it bad, was it right, was it wrong? It's just showing what happened at that time and the sorts of things going on. And it wasn't, a greatly fantasized version of it. Because we had a range of characters. I mean, let's be honest, the only one who really came across as having a decent sense of morality and so forth was the one who had been hanging for being a coward, which was quite interesting. Well, because
again,
of course,
yes, I know. He's called Colonel Godsaker.
Oh, Colonel God. You see, Gatiss has even got that wonderful relish for Dickensian words, hasn't he? He's got that.
He got the names from a tombstone or something. He got the names from tombstones.
Really? Wow.
If that is fast to be believed, yes.
Gosh, that wouldn't surprise me. I can imagine Mark Gatiss spends a lot of time going around looking at tombstones. You know, he's in fact, I don't know if this is going to put off me, but I've always wanted to go to Highgate Cemetery in London.
Right.
And have a good look around there, but I've never managed to persuade anyone else to come with me. But it's you know, it's got such a fabulous sense of history there, isn't it? You know, and one day I'll go there.
Be careful,
you know.
There might be weeping angels in there.
Oh, gosh, great, yes. That's it. I won't blink, I'll look carefully.
But you're right, actually, because cowardice was a theme of this story, and when you see last night's episode, the one by Rona Munro, cowardice is also a theme of that story as well. So not only do you have whole Bill falling down a hole 2 weeks running, you have cowardice 2 weeks running as well.
Really? No, this is, as you've just let listeners know, I haven't actually seen this week's episode yet, but I'll be watching that within the next day or so, probably either late tonight or tomorrow, and we'll be bringing out another review very quickly so that we've caught up, David, isn't it?
Oh, that'd be good. I think the best line of the show, I'm awarding best line, went to Bill, because when she challenged Godsaker's opinion of the impossibility of a policewoman, she said, "I'm going to forgive your Victorian attitudes because you are actually Victorian." So I thought it was a great throwaway line. I mean, I'm sure the younger viewers like the Doctor's reference to Frozen. That would have gone down extremely well with them.
Oh, gosh, I vaguely got, I know it's some sort of Disney film or something, is it?
Yes, it is.
That one wasn't really for me.
I'm going to forgive you your Victorian attitudes because you are actually Victorian.
Beautiful. I love that. That is so good. And she acted that so well, because she started losing her temper, but then she thought it through, didn't she?
Yes.
You can see her looking and going and saying that line. I thought that was really nicely done. Ooh, you know, yeah. It was. What did you think? Sorry, David, have you got more notes?
Well, I've got a few more notes, but we can work our way through. I was just going to say to you, one thing I really, really loved visually about this episode were those steampunk spacesuits.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember the TARDIS crew had reasonably modern-looking spacesuits that sort of had an intercom, and the Colonel had one which had a sort of a gramophone horn coming out the side and made his speech very tinny.
Yes, it was lovely, wasn't it? And it was even a little sort of like a little brass gramophone, was it? Had that effect. It was lovely, yeah. Oh, there was so much, the detail in here, it was lovely, and never once did I feel that we were in a studio or there was something going on. It felt very organic, I think. And I thought the Ice Warriors costumes were lit beautifully. I love that scene where Friday turns to camera, he turns left to camera, and we see his damaged, smashed eye that he'd had in the accident.
Yes,
and I thought, I like that. Yes. It's always nice to see. And of course, the reveal of the hangman's noose on the neck.
Right.
Yeah, that was quite a macabre Dickensian thing as well, wasn't it?
I did have a slight problem with the idea that he had survived his execution. But
right.
I think that, well, it's simply because, you know, we know we're set in 1881, and without wishing to be too anarchy or technical,
yeah.
only 7 years before that, long drop hanging became universal in Britain in 1874.
Oh.
So when one of those hangings is botched, the head tends to be removed from the body. But
yes.
he'd obviously been lynched, hadn't he? Somebody had lynched him and left him hanging for a long time, and I assume that his trachea had failed to collapse and they'd failed to kill him, or I don't know. But it's all a very fantastical story, if that's my biggest quibble, that it wasn't brutal enough.
Well, it's quite interesting you said that, actually, because you have your gruesome knowledge of those details, David, has reminded me of, you know, visits to places like Bodmin Jail and so forth, where, yeah, I can remember reading about that now, that they changed over to the long drop, wasn't it?
Yeah,
which
so
is pretty
no,
much...
there's no surviving that.
No. But of course, it used to be the short drop before it.
The short
it, where
drop,
they...
but I mean, that had much the same effect most of the times. I mean, yeah, but let's not get caught up on it. You know, it was obviously a strangulation hanging that hadn't worked. And
yeah,
I think he must
yeah.
have been sort of, it must have been some sort of kangaroo court, and he must have been lynched. But
yeah,
They did say he's been dancing the Newgate Polka, which makes,
because
Newgate, of course, was the dedicated site of execution. It replaced, I suppose, Tyburn or wherever, but anyway, it was what in Victorian times it was what the place was for, you know, judicially kill people. But anyway, I'm not going to hold that against Mark Gatiss at all.
No, not at all. That's well, what do you think? So we're coming up to the end of the story. Things are have been resolved and worked out, and lead us into it, David, because
I was just going to make a couple more points. One of the strongest performances in there was from Sir Ben Kingsley's son, Ferdinand Kingsley, as Captain Catchlove.
Was that Ben Kingsley?
Yes, that was Ben Kingsley's son, and Catchlove was just an out-and-out bounder, wasn't he? It was
absolutely
great to get a character in the show at last where our reception of him is not even remotely blurred.
Yes,
it was a great little performance there.
Oh, really, my gosh, I did
that.
Yeah, he was great. And, you know, it's quite interesting. You mentioned the Sarah Dollard story earlier, because, of course, we had the character in there, didn't we? The aristocratic character in the Tory blue coat.
Yeah,
but that was all a bit over the place, wasn't it? But this was... this characterisation was great.
And another little characterisation I liked was Vince, the young soldier.
Oh, yes.
Because do you know what? The minute he got that picture of his intended out, and the minute he started telling his co-worker about his wedding plans, you just knew he wasn't going to make it.
You just knew, but you did.
At least he got a nice character moment before the inevitable struck him.
Well, but this is how it's done, you see, isn't it? This is always give us a little bit of humanity for us to wipe it away with a horrible, you know, killing.
Yeah, let us connect with the characters. And something that may have brought you out in a cold sweat, but I personally didn't mind. I don't know if you spotted, but when Araxa woke the hive up, she shouted, "Sleep no more," repeatedly.
She did.
She did. And that was a bit of an in-joke there as well.
He was, I thought, I wondered actually, did Mark Gatiss say, "Can I screech that bit?" Because that's how I, because he had such flack. Because we diverge in our opinions of Sleep No More, I think,
do we?
Yeah, we'll talk about that one time. But that was really good, actually. But, of course, there was another hidden little Who reference in there, going right back.
Is it to do with food or drink? When
the
guy takes the Mickey Finn off of Jackdaw and sups it down and goes to sleep.
Oh,
but he justifies taking the liquid when Vince says, "Don't I get any?" And he says, "Oh, yeah. HAP, lad.
The Brigadier. Has
its privileges." Well, Captain Yates.
Captain Yates.
Grant in Day of the Daleks. Because we are coming to the end, and I know we are. But the one tiny little thing that I thought would be explained and wasn't was the sudden dematerialisation of the TARDIS, just when it mattered.
Yes.
Because we all know that Nardole has seriously taken this oath very seriously.
Yes.
So something pretty serious must have happened in order for him to let Missy out of the vault.
Well,
and it wasn't explained.
It wasn't explained, and it was also, I think there's something, well, you've had the advantage over here, dear, because you've seen this week's episode. It wasn't explained in that either, was it?
No, I'm afraid it wasn't explained.
Oh, that's a pity. I had the expectation that it would be explained, but clearly
back to the last podcast, that made Missy the MacGuffin, because she turned up to resolve their problem out of nowhere. Yes.
Well, what was all that stuff? Because she was saying right to the end, "Are you all right, Doctor?" Wasn't it? Because he was acting as if he were feeling faint or not right. I don't know.
Well, I think it's because they didn't expect to see her, and Nardole had done something really quite foolish in releasing her. But there was never any consequence to that, because, as I said at the beginning, they were at NASA without her. So nothing bad actually happened.
Yes.
Why the TARDIS dematerialised when it did was never explained, ever.
That is really strange, isn't it?
And on that bombshell, I'm going to let you do the end big reveal.
Oh, well, I tell you what, I think in Who fandom, there's a term called squeal, isn't it? Is it squeal or squee?
Squee.
Squee.
It's when squee. You say, "Game of Thrones is coming back, squee."
That's it. Well, I had that moment, and I'm guessing a lot of people had that moment, and I hope you had that moment.
Oh, I had that moment, yes.
When that scanner came on, and of course we had the wonderful character of Alpha Centauri, and just her face, but even better than that, it was the original actress's voice doing the voice, which is,
Eason. Eason Churchman, but I could be wrong. It sort of looks like a bit of a French name to me. Eason.
Yes.
He was always male, actually, in the Pertwee years. Always male, because John Pertwee used to say, "Alpha Centauri, my dear fellow."
Do you remember?
But the character was always androgynous. You couldn't sex it.
You couldn't sex it? David, is that an in-joke?
Oh, to Lenny Mayne's reference. No, it could be. But yes,
of course
I had a full-on squee when Alpha Centauri came out.
Me too. I thought it was fabulous to see. I wish they'd recreated the costume, actually, because she was a great character, was she, in the job who he is. And I always remember, because I must have been about 7, 8, 9, something like that, when I first saw her. And because we, in that one, the Peladon story, the first one, The Curse of Peladon, we had this fabulous array of creatures coming in, strange.
Oh, and Arcturus.
Yes. and all really good characters in their own right, isn't it? And
really.
And he stood out wonderfully, and it was just lovely to see that face come back up on the screen,
wasn't it? Yes.
Yeah. Do you think there was a reason why they didn't recreate the costume or show him, her in full regalia? Or
perhaps they didn't need to. It was only a very brief cameo, and it seems to have entirely hit the spot with what they gave us. I mean, they only gave us the voice for most of it, and then the screen fuzzed through, and there was Alpha Centauri.
Oh, gosh. It was brilliant. I absolutely loved it. And so nice of her. Oh, she's 90-something, isn't she? 92. Gosh, isn't that fabulous? Absolutely. That was a real treat I didn't expect. And I had the feeling of, you know, right at the end of this show, you know, just before we had the missy bit, you know, of feeling very, very satisfied. I had the smiles, the thrills, the adventure, those lovely warm reminiscences and feeling. Oh, it was just great. Mm. Really enjoyed it.
Mm.
And you, David?
Oh, I enjoyed it as well. I've got a score in mind. Have you got a score in mind?
I have got a score in mind. I have got a score in mind. And now we've wavered a lot this season, I think, haven't we?
Mm.
We've wavered a lot. Mm. And I've got a feeling that we've tended to favour the stories that are self-contained and full-on adventures. We seem to have given the other, you know, the better scores.
We gave Oxygen 9, didn't we? We gave Oxygen 9.
And
that's
I
the highest
thoroughly
score this year.
Yeah, and if you want me to go first, David, I am going to match that 9 for this.
Really?
I'm going to give it a 9. I absolutely loved it. It was, what can you complain about? What it provided everything you could possibly want from an hour's Doctor Who.
Absolutely, as the famous Victorian writer Oscar Wilde once explained, the good ended happily and the bad unhappily. That is what fiction means. And that epigram just sums up my whole feelings about Empress of Mars to an absolute T. And you know what? I'm going to actually score this a little bit higher than you.
What?
Yes, I am going to give this 9.5.
Wow. Wow. Oh, do you know, it sort of lifts my heart, though, to hear when we give scores like that. And I mean, it's coming across in your voice very clearly how much you enjoyed this and all the different little pleasures we've had from it, whether it's little throwbacks to old classic Who, the feelings, the monsters, you know, the suspense. It's really great. 9.5, that's absolutely fabulous. And, you know, The only reason I didn't go higher than a 9, I think, was I reserved my 10s for something utterly spectacular. I mean, I think I gave Heaven Sent a 10.
Right.
Because that was something utterly out of this world, wasn't it?
Right.
That's the epitome of something different in Doctor Who. But this... You know, you couldn't score less than a 9, but 9.5 is a wonderful score, David. Really, really pleased with that. So we've had about 3 crackers this season, I think.
We've had some good, we've had the good, the bad and the ugly this year.
Oh, we have. Well, David, could you give me, without any spoilers, a little heads up for last night's episode, which I haven't seen
yet? Last night's episode, I don't know how I can give you a heads up without spoiling it. It's got the theme of cowardice, as I've already implied, and Bill falls down another hole. And it is by, and this is exciting, it is by the only author to have contributed to the classic series, contributing to New Who. So it's Rona Munro, famous Scottish playwright, having written Survival. So you'd like to think that all the omens are there for this next episode to be something special as well.
Oh my gosh, I'm so looking forward to that, which I will be watching in about 3 hours' time. I'd be like, once I've done some bits and pieces, I'm going to do that. Well, David, it's been absolutely fabulous talking about this today. And we're going to get cracking straight away with the review of this one. It's going to be out within the next couple of days of that Rona Munro one. And I'd like to say thank you for talking with me today about that story.
Thank you.
Please tweet us at Doctor Who on Target. That's DR Who on Target. Or email us at DoctorWhoOnTarget@gmail.com. That's the end of this episode, and I would like to thank BBC Audio and Penguin Random House for kindly supplying us with preview copies, and to Smerin's Antisocial Club for the use of their version of the Doctor Who theme tune. The biggest thank you goes to you, our listeners.